Are you looking for a podcast that is the perfect blend of paranormal and pop culture?
Starting off with spooky stuff where we talk cryptids and ghosts.
And then we have our pop culture section where we sometimes have celebrity guests.
Whoa.
Yeah, do you want more?
Boy, howdy.
There's always genre news and all kinds of celebrity deaths. All kinds of it. If you're a celebrity and you die, we're going to talk about it.
I actually was hoping for UFOs.
Well, bet your ass we got that too at the end.
Earthling Entertainment. New episodes every Thursday.
Make sure to check us out anywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Zombie Strains, the podcast that watches all the zombie films. Today, we have a naive mentor.
You're ambitious, yet you're a dedicated genius, not an unscrupulous madman.
Family drama.
He murdered your father.
And a condescending detective.
Then you think that one of your bullets at least struck the murderer, although it doesn't seem you shot them out at all.
That's right. This week, we have 1965's Dr. Orloff's Monster.
You know, I've seen people act like that in pictures. What do they call them? Zombies or something?
Zombie.
What's a zombie?
Just what is a zombie?
Well, a zombie, there's, Mr. Bill is...
The living dead.
They are the living dead.
Get into zombies.
He's a zombie.
Because a zombie has no will of his own.
It's an army of zombies. No armies could stand.
What is wrong? What is wrong?
Well, welcome, everybody, to the Internet's only international zombie podcast as we watch zombie films from around the world. I'm John.
I'm Andy.
And I'm Brad.
Yes. Hello, producer Brad. Yeah, this one is, I can't tell if it's French, German, or Spanish because I listened to it with an English dub. So it's got a lot going on. How about that?
In your intro, from that clip you played in the intro, so I think the era of the robot is behind us.
No, but in my English dub, the detective says robot.
He does.
Okay. Well, I did wonder because that clip featured the phrase madman. So I wonder if we have a new word. As robot exits the stage, if madman is maybe
madman.
Entering it.
It's the madmans, you know. We'll have the madmans over for dinner. Yeah, exactly. This is an interesting one. I'm excited to get to talk about it. But first, anybody have any fun movie stuff or zombie stuff they've experienced recently that they want to share with the crowd?
I have a couple of orders of business to go over, guys.
Let's hear them.
I'm sorry. Brace yourselves. I think I have three things I want to mention.
Yes.
First, so Valentine's Day was a little while ago, and my wife got me a lovely gift. And that gift was a miniature of Vincent Price.
Oh,
which has a bunch of different paraphernalia from his different movies that you can.
It's like a Vincent Price action figure.
Yeah, basically. It's like an action figure. You could put like a raven on him. There's a bunch of skulls. There's all sorts of cool stuff. So
that's amazing.
Yes. Let's see. Item number two. I've heard from a listener who is also my mother that I say the word shenanigans too much in this podcast. So I did go back and listen to a few past episodes, and I do appear to say shenanigans about every 40 seconds. So
all right.
Feel free to help me come up with a different word that conveys the same subtle nuance as shenanigan.
We'll make a pact. I'll stop saying for sure, and you stop saying shenanigans.
Okay. All right. Let's hold each other to it. Producer Brad will make sure.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I haven't noticed the shenanigans.
Okay. I think we just enjoy the word.
Yes.
So it does remind me of a dad joke I heard, which is, well, if she shenans, she's going to shenan again.
Okay, that's kind of funny.
Yeah,
and also,
sorry.
Yeah, I mean, shenanigans just encompasses so much of just the boring garbage that these movies
often. It's a fun word it's a word that gives too much credit to the films we watch sometimes. How about that?
My third quick item is, as far as zombie cinema, not a lot, except I've started watching the 1974 TV show Kolchak, The Night Stalker.
Oh, yeah. Have you ever watched it before?
I have never seen it before. No.
I watched it a long time ago.
I have not.
So there is an episode coming up. I have not yet watched it. And the episode is just called Zombie. And the preview image is of a very stereotypical looking woman in voodoo garb. So
interesting.
I wonder if we're going to veer back into the early days of the zombie with its basis in Haiti and voodoo, or I don't know what's happening, what's coming up, but I'll get to it soon.
Well, I would be curious if, like for us, right, 1968, we are barreling towards 1968 and the Night of the Living Dead. But I think at the time, like, people thought that was a cool idea, but I don't think it had completely co-opted the zombie term yet. That probably took some time.
I am curious. I mean, we're a podcast. We do movies. We generally don't do TV shows, but I do wonder if at a certain point it might be worth doing kind of a catch-all episode that snags a few episodes from TV shows in the 50s, 60s, 70s that featured zombies, just to see how they reflect or don't reflect what's happening in zombie film.
That sounds like a fun idea, actually.
Yeah.
My only comment is stay tuned.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
All right. I'd like to hear
I'm
that.
I'm excited. All right. That's all three of my important critical updates. How about the rest of you?
Those were great. And hi, Andy's mom. What's your mom's name?
Debbie.
Hi, Debbie. Hey, anything from you, producer Brad?
Nope. My week was quiet. No zombies.
Well, I had a good week. No zombies for me, except for Dr. Orloff. My son was home, and he picks movies that he considers quote-unquote classics that we watch together. So this has ranged from Tombstone to 2001 A Space Odyssey to other things. This week, his choice was Fight Club, which is a movie I only think I saw once in the theater. Not that I hate it, but it was interesting to see today. Partially because if there were cell phones, that movie couldn't exist. Like, the plot and the twist of it just wouldn't happen with cellular telephones. So anyway, it's just one of those artifacts from the late 90s.
Yeah, and I guess I don't want to spoil a 30-year-old movie, but doesn't it kind of end with something that no longer works quite as well in film as it did maybe in the 90s?
No, it does. It does. It's got a twist. And I will say this is peak cool Brad Pitt, though.
Yeah.
Like he ends up being awful, but like as he's strutting around in his ridiculous outfits and sunglasses, smoking cigarettes with bruises all over his face, like he just looks so cool and cocky throughout the whole film. It's kind of amazing.
That has Helena Bonham Carter in it, right?
It does.
Is there any actor more just locked into the decade? Into a decade than Helena Bonham Carter in the 90s?
No, she looks like a goth person.
Yeah.
Speaking of the gothic film we're about to watch.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have a couple of things. So we watched Fight Club, and then I saw, actually before we watched Fight Club, I watched the Oscar-nominated Train Dreams, and I am now dedicating my life to telling everyone to watch this film.
Okay.
Like, I gave it 4.5 stars. I'm going to go back and give it 5. Like, it's... You know, if you know what I mean when I say like Terrence Malick style of sort of wonder inducing film, it's that kind of film. It looks like I don't know if it was shot on film or not. It's the best looking, most gorgeous film. And in fact, my son walked in once. I was halfway through it in tears because it's a very sad film. And I paused the movie to talk to him, and he said, "That looks like a painting." And it was just a frame from the movie. So if you like that sort of deep sort of, you know, reflective, metaphysical, sort of beautiful film, like Train Dreams has got you all the way. It's great. So
does it have zombies though?
No.
Okay. So minus 2 stars right off the bat.
Why was it in my zombie segment?
I had to.
Well, John did say he was dedicating his life to evangelizing the good news of this film. So
yes, there's a certain type of person who thinks this kind of film is pretentious and boring, and I see it. I understand that. When a film like this doesn't work, it's a disaster, but this one works. So that's what I'll say.
Okay.
All right, enough non-zombie talk. Let's get into the zombie talk. This week, we're watching Dr. Orloff's Monster. We have a lot to say about it. All right, so producer Brad, tell us about the making and release of this film.
Dr. Orloff's Monster was released in Spain in 1965 and in France in 1966. It's also known as Dr. Jekyll's Mistresses, The Brides of Dr. Jekyll, and The Secret of Dr. Orloff. Jess Franco was a Spanish filmmaker. He co-wrote and directed this film. He is considered one of the early pioneers in Spanish horror. His given name is Jesus, but he often used Jess to make his films more marketable.
I'd also like to comment, this film is hard to find.
Yes.
Like, it's just not lying around out there on the internet like so many of these films.
Well, this was a low-budget film, and it looked like, well, I'll tell you, I'll get to the end, and I'll talk about its distribution problems. Franco studied music in school. In Dr. Orloff's Monster, he has a cameo as the piano player in the club scenes. Do you remember him?
Yes, I do.
That is the director, Jess Franco. In the 1950s, Franco worked on many films in a variety of capacities. He wrote screenplays, composed scores, and worked as an assistant director. He directed his first film in 1959. In 1960, he was inspired by Hammer's The Bride of Dracula to make horror movies. Frankel directed his first, The Awful Dr. Orloff, in 1962.
Okay, that was confusing as heck, because when I was searching for this movie, I found that movie all over the place.
The Orloff films are very hard to research because sometimes things are retroed into Orloff by a dub or a subtitle, and so I can't commit to what the full list of films are without a lot of academic research.
Right.
In The Awful Dr. Orloff, Dr. Orloff's daughter has burn scars, so he kidnaps young women to graft skin onto his daughter's face. So there are some similarities to this film, as when we get into it, you'll discover.
Yeah. Huh.
Dr. Orloff's monster is not a sequel to the first film. Howard Vernon played Orloff in the first film, but the budget for Orloff's monster was too small to bring Vernon back. Vernon did later play Orloff in three more Franco films, and Franco made at least five Orloff films between 1962 and 1988.
I'm curious about this now.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in the Orloff world. There's a movie in the 80s called, Franco did The Fall of the House of Usher, and some people consider it an Orloff film because it's similar, and I think there are dubs that switch the names.
So there's an Orloff verse is what you're saying.
Which is a little weird because Orloff is in this movie for about 90 seconds.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
He bookends the film.
Yeah. I thought it was the main character's last name was Dr. Orloff because he was in the whole movie. And I just made the assumption. I didn't realize until before we started recording that I had it backwards. So anyway.
So now that you know, we'll get into this, but who is Dr. Orloff and who is the monster in the film?
Yes, we will get into that because now I like the title more.
How many movies have we watched where there were two mad scientists?
Yes, but we also have an ethical mad scientist and an unethical mad scientist, yeah. Which is a new twist, I think.
Jess Franco described his films from the early 60s as his museum pieces. Franco's career shifted more towards exploitation movies in the late 60s and the 70s. He directed films like Vampiros Lesbos in 1971 and The Erotic Rites of Frankenstein in 1973.
Nice. Don't forget Two Female Spies with Flowered Panties from 1980.
That would be later, yes. And then later he does go to hardcore too, but we'll get to that.
Oh, man, dear.
That podcast, podcast we're doing with the good movie titles is racking up movies.
Yeah. We had, who was it that we just had another director that followed this exact same path? And I cannot remember. Was it the Teenage Zombies guy? Maybe.
Well, I think what we're about to see is that many of these guys in the 60s, the exploitation films in the 70s start to blossom.
Yes.
And there's a lot of crossover between horror and exploitation.
Yeah, and there's a lot of exploitation in this movie as well. Like it's just any shot of a half-naked woman it goes for. So
in 1989, Franco directed the film Night of the Eagle starring Christopher Lee and Mark Hamill. So did work with big-name stars. But he also did hardcore porn in the 80s and 90s. And yet, in 2013, the Spanish Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences awarded him their Lifetime Achievement Award. He died in 2013 with 204 directing credits, and four of those films are on our zombie list.
Wow.
Still to come are A Virgin Among the Living Dead, Oasis of the Zombies, and Mansion of the Living Dead.
Those last two sound pretty good. And the last two are 30 years apart. Holy moly.
I was going to say the first one sounded good. And the last two sounded not as good. But I guess that's why we have two hosts on the show, folks.
That's right.
Well, the A Virgin Among the Living Dead film, Andy, is going to be a pretty strong exploitation film.
Uh-oh. We're in trouble.
Just heads up.
Yeah. We're not ready for the 70s, Andy.
Daniel White scored the film. He was a Brit who lived in Paris. He was a frequent collaborator with Franco. And I think we all agree that the score for this film is pretty great.
Yes.
Yes.
In fact, I asked you to pull a couple of just music sequences in it. Yeah.
Agnes Spock played Melissa, the niece of the mad scientist and daughter of the zombie. Does that remind you of another film we've watched?
Yes, it does. It reminds me of a number of films, but specifically The Frozen Dead.
Correct, because also in that film, the niece comes back to the castle from school to visit her uncle and believing her father's dead only to discover that he is a zombie.
Yep, and there's the don't go in my lab business in both.
Now, Spock only acted for 10 years before she turned to photography. She became a successful fashion photographer and is still active. You can find her work on Instagram.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
She even posted last in February, so I don't know how old she is, but she's still going. Marcello Arota Oregi played the mad scientist Dr. Fisherman, or Jekyll, depending on which version you watch. This is one of the few leading roles he had. Hugh Blanco plays Andros, the zombie. This is his third film. Franco gave him his first big role in 1962 in the film The Sadistic Baron von Klaus.
Oh, dear.
And then he had a steady career in spaghetti westerns after this.
Was he the villain in spaghetti westerns? I could see him as the villain.
I haven't seen any of the films, but he looks grizzled.
He's a creepy looking guy. Yeah. Like I can easily see him being typecast as the villain in a lot of westerns.
Yeah, maybe like if he ever smiles, that like changes his face, but I'm skeptical.
Dr. Orloff's Monster had distribution problems. In Spain, it was distributed by a small company that had limited reach. In France, it was retitled The Mistresses of Dr. Jekyll, which Franco disliked and thought harmed the film's success. He thought it should have had Orloff in the title. And while the film did have a Canadian theatrical release, the film went straight to TV in the U.S., airing in April of 1966.
I assume they cut out all the gratuitous shots of women with their clothing off from behind and that kind of stuff.
I think it's safe to say American TV was pretty chaste in the 60s.
I think so. All right. So, I'm curious about the invocation of Dr. Jekyll by the French, because it's not – there is a contrast, right, between Dr. Orloff and Conrad Fisherman, the actual mad scientist, but it's not that much. Like it's like Conrad isn't a lunatic. I mean, he is a lunatic, but he's not like a slavering killer. You know what I mean? But he is like a slavering killer. So Andy, you know what? Let's refresh people on historical context. We've been in the '60s for a while. It's 1965. So maybe just even if you don't know what's going on in Spain, France, and Germany, what's going on in the U.S. at this time?
Yeah, so for a more in-depth look at how we think the events of the 60s influence horror, go back a couple of episodes and listen to our episode specifically devoted to that. That said, here we are in 1965, and just as a quick refresher, so JFK was recently assassinated in America. LBJ is president. And probably the most important, you know, quote, important global event going on is that the Vietnam War is starting to expand, I guess. So it won't be until the later 60s where it really explodes into the big divisive international debacle that it was. But in the mid 60s, it was definitely a fire that was burning.
Yeah.
And I was quite frankly confused about the nationality and location of this film, which got in the way of my looking up historical facts about that country. So, So just remember the 60s, you know, the 60s are underway, and
the civil rights movement, Andy, is also a huge thing that is still divisive in our country, sadly, to this day. So it's a big landmark as well.
So I did wonder about this. You know, this film, like a couple of other movies we've watched that were either gothic or sort of adjacent to gothic, felt more disconnected from like contemporary events. It felt a little slippery trying to figure out what it might have been riffing on from pop culture at the time. And I wonder if that in itself is kind of significant. All right. Well, I did have one specific thing that came up in this movie that sent me down a little bit of an internet rabbit trail.
Oh, yeah.
John, you'll recall in this movie, there is a couple of scenes that take place in what I would describe as an opium den.
Yes.
Do you agree with this?
In my notes, I was like, wait, are we in an opium den? What is happening?
Yeah. Yeah. So this sent me down a little bit of a trail. So history-wise, So opium dens were kind of on their way out by the mid-century. They weren't really a thing. John, in the 50s and 60s, what European country do you think was the last refuge of the opium den? And do you have a guess as to why?
My instinct is France, and my reason is because they're French.
The answer is France, specifically the city of Paris. Uh-huh. And the reason is a bunch of French soldiers were returning from French Indochina and other areas around it. And they were bringing back this, they were keeping the opium den idea alive, I guess you might say.
Oh, weird.
So into the 60s, you could plausibly in France have been going to an opium den where you would lay around getting high on opium. That said, pretty quickly, the opium den gave way to, I guess, more sordid ways to get your high.
Yeah.
And that is with the shooting gallery is what replaced the opium den. And the shooting gallery was a much seedier, like, we're going to rent a room, we're going to rent an apartment for a couple of weeks. And in there, you could get heroin, which hit a lot harder than the opium you would get in an opium den. And it just got a lot seedier and grosser and more depressing, I guess. But this film,
the good features, old days of opium addiction, man.
That's right. This film manages to make the opium den look, have a tinge of nostalgia to it. So
yeah, yes, it's very artfully shot. All right. Well, let me summarize this movie. I think what we're going to do is I'm going to do a summary of the plot beginning to end, and then we're going to go through and just sort of pick out the best parts. I don't think we'll cover every plot element like we have for some in the past. So let me start.
Yeah, and hey, listeners, you know, this is a slight change of format. We're just experimenting with something a little different. We would love to hear from you what's working and what's not. So yeah, just drop
us a note.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we open with a man lying on a bed, and he's having a flashback about catching somebody in the act of having an affair. And as we go through the film, we realize that this is a Dr. Conrad Fishman, and he lives in an isolated castle conducting experiments that we learn are to control a reanimated human corpse. Into this mix comes his niece, the daughter of the corpse, Melissa. Also here are Ingrid, his long-suffering wife, and Melissa's sweetheart, Juan Manuel. As they go through this film, Conrad goes through and uses his zombie to take vengeance on the woman who cheated on him by murdering showgirls and musicians throughout the film until he starts to get sloppy. And the police start to catch up with him. And it all sort of culminates with the police arriving to arrest him just as Melissa is about to be murdered. And it has quite an exciting ending, which we'll cover in more detail. But did I miss any of the big plot points there?
No, I think that's the big plot point. Maybe the big thing to address here is the confusion of names throughout this film. So I don't know about you, John. I watched this in the, I think, original French with English subtitles.
Right.
And the names were very confusing. So Conrad was called Dr. Jekyll.
Yes.
So, and a few other characters had slightly different names. So we'll go with the way you referred to them. But I did a little Googling around and reading on this movie, and it does make it a little confusing because there does not seem to be an agreed upon standard for what the names of the characters are in this film.
No, it's very strange. And I watched it in English because I wanted to pull, even though the dub isn't great, I wanted to pull some clips. And they only say Dr. Fishman like once near the end. And then I had to turn off the English subtitles because they were so far from what was being said on the screen that I just listened to it. I didn't do any subtitles. So,
but they did show that name later in the cemetery at the tombstone.
That's right.
That's where it says Fishman or Fisherman.
This is so strange. Okay. So our main mad villain is not Dr. Orloff. So let's get to the details and talk about how we got here. So like I said, I just want to cover the beginning because I think it's crucial. So we start with Dr. Fishman. He's lying on a bed and he's having this flashback of he's sort of looking through a door and he locks eyes with a man, and the woman in bed with the man has her back to him. And we realize this is a haunting memory for him. We find out throughout the movie that what he's actually done is that man is his brother and that woman is his wife, Ingrid. And what he does is kill his brother and bring him back to life as a zombie. But it's not that simple. So let's start with some of the important things. So the Dr. Orloff in this movie is not this man. It's not Dr. Fishman. It is his mentor, a professor named Dr. Orloff, who has uncovered the secret to controlling reanimated corpses. And he wasn't going to tell Dr. Fishman, But when Dr. Fishman looks so forlorn at not being able to control his newly created zombies, Dr. Orloff caves and tells him how to do it. Like, is there anything you want to say about that?
It's those big puppy dog eyes from the mad scientist.
Yeah, it's absolutely bizarre.
But he also, like in our opening clip, Dr. Orloff says, I know I can trust you. You won't be a madman about it.
Yep. Oops. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's sort of our opening. Then we have a murder. Right, of a different woman that happens. So Dr. Orloff likes, what he likes to do throughout this film is go to like nightclubs and at one point an opium den, meet women, and then they end up getting murdered by his zombie. And we'll get into the mechanics of that later. In what seems like Dr. Orloff taking vengeance against all women for the betrayal of a single woman, it's a little majorly psychotic. As a character. Is that how you interpreted his actions?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the movie does not really explain why he's doing what he's doing. I think we can guess that he's taking out his anger against his wife on other women, I guess.
It's became such a trope. The interesting thing about that is it is such a trope in like 70s and 80s, like slasher killer bad guy movies that I don't think we've seen it before in the movies we've watched. Now, it could have happened outside of zombie movies, but this feels very like 1960s Freudian psychology to the rescue of creating a motivation for a man and putting it in the background, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, well, this might be one of our first zombie masters who is not using his zombies for a, quote, rational purpose.
No.
Like, he doesn't stand to gain from the nefarious deeds he sends his zombie off to do.
No.
Instead, it's what he does with his zombie is more a reflection of his own psychological angst.
Yes. Yes.
He's not claiming to push science forward. He's not looking for a claim for his work. None of that.
No, he's just a murderer who doesn't like to get his hands dirty. It's very strange. Okay, so in this first act, we also meet his niece, Melissa. And we meet his wife, Ingrid, who lives in a Gothic castle. And the plot is Melissa comes home from school. She visits her uncle at the castle, and they're going to sort of settle her father's estate once and for all. She'll inherit all the money. She knows her father is dead. She does not know that Conrad actually did it, but that's part of the plot that we'll get to. But what Melissa is thrown into, she gets a ride there from a guy who's sweet on her that's trying to catch her attention. That's Juan Manuel. And then she goes to the castle, and he's like, well, I'll stay at the hotel in town in case you want to, you know, go get a drink or something. And Melissa is thrown into this Gothic castle with this weird caretaker named Cicero and this alcoholic woman named Ingrid who's talks about nothing but how miserable she is. And she barely sees her uncle Conrad. It's very strange. I don't want to go for it beat by beat, but when they are at dinner together, I think this clip pretty much sums up the dynamic of this family.
Is there a reason to think that youth has the power to make us immune to death? I know that my days are numbered in this vale of sorrows, but that's why I'm impatient. Most impatient.
He's playing a tragedian tonight, and it suits him. What's the matter now? Are you scared or bothered by conscience?
Hold your tongue!
I will not. I will not. I'm sick and tired of talking to no one. I've lived too many years alone. I've lived too many years shut up in this odious castle.
Come now, control yourself. I'm quite aware of your nervous condition. Forgive me.
So, that's what Melissa finds herself in the middle of. That was Conrad talking to his wife, Ingrid. What did she call him there, Andy? Did that make sense to you? I did not catch it.
Like, I would have said tragedian.
Ah, that's probably it. Like the gloomy.
Yeah.
Like a gloomy,
melodramatic.
Forlorn. Yes.
Character. Yeah.
I gotcha. Okay, that makes sense to me.
Have you ever, by the way, this just calls to mind. Have you ever, like, when you were younger, did you ever go over to a friend's house and like their parents were having an argument like at the dinner table or something like that?
Like, not exactly like that, but I did.
A special kind of awkwardness when you're a guest and your hosts are arguing with each other.
Yeah, I remember I had a friend whose father was much more a disciplinarian than my parents were. And like, he got in trouble and like, that was super awkward.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't get in trouble that often. Isn't that me you're talking about?
Yeah. No, Brad, if there's a parent that I think of as an extreme disciplinarian, your father does not come to mind, nor does your mother, but you know, don't, this is not the time to reveal any secrets either, producer Brad. So,
right.
In any case, so far we've got Dr. Fishman. He's got this formula from Dr. Orloff. He can now control a zombie. He's used the zombie to murder a random showgirl that he met. And now Melissa is in the middle of all of this. Just to set the tone, there's a wonderful scene where she's walking into the castle and they just sort of longingly shoot the parapets and the towers in the castle to make her to just sort of show how oppressive it is. And then at one point, Ingrid is having a nightmare, and I'm not going to play the nightmare here, but there's this the soundtrack of this is wonderful for a horror movie, and here's a sample of the music that's playing during her thrashing nightmare. I'm sorry to laugh at Ingrid. That is so good horror movie music. Yeah, like every horror movie should have music like this. But, you know, that's sort of the beginning of the movie, the setup, the first act. Andy, is there anything you wanted to pull out of that I didn't mention?
I think so. I want to talk about the zombie because this is a movie. There are movies we've watched where the zombie is there in the first 60 seconds. There are movies we've watched where the zombie appears in the last 60 seconds.
Yes.
This is a movie that introduces us to a zombie pretty fast. So pretty early on in this sort of first act of the film, we see Conrad up in his mad scientist lair complete with a human skull, and we see him successfully controlling a zombie he's resurrected. So do you want to talk a little bit about that? What is we know who our zombie is pretty much right up front in this film.
Yes.
And at the beginning of this film, Conrad has just learned the secret of controlling a zombie from his well-intentioned but naive mentor. So yes. What is that secret, John? And then maybe let's talk about what it looks like when the zombie is kind of animated and then sent off to do Conrad's bidding.
Yeah, so the secret is manipulating ultrasonic, like sub human hearing sounds, though we can hear them throughout the movie, that he sort of tweaks to get Andros is the zombie's name, to get him to do different things. And this works with a varying degree of results.
Yeah.
Sometimes it works great, sometimes it doesn't work at all. So it's interesting. He sort of has a machine that he uses that emits frequencies and that can make the zombie do stuff. So, for example, whenever the zombie kills one of these showgirls on behalf of Dr. Fishman, there's this like grating ultrasonic, you know, high pitched sound playing in the background all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. So the zombie he's resurrected is Andros, Melissa's father.
And his brother. Yeah, Conrad's brother.
Also the brother of Conrad.
And he looks like a cool guy, 1960s spy. He's got a black suit on with a black turtleneck and shiny black shoes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He looks like something out of Austin Powers, actually.
Does he have some like burn scarring on his face?
So I think they'd have put makeup on him, and it's, I think, to make him look a little dead and decayed, but it's not, okay. It's not super convincing, and it's not super...
It's like parchment paper looking.
Yeah.
It's wrinkled. His face is cracking.
Yeah, it's like when you put, I don't know if you ever did this when you were a kid, you put Elmer's glue on your hand and you let it dry and then you peel it off, you know, like that's what it looks like.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we have, you know, we have a science zombie, I think I would say.
I think so, yeah.
No hint of voodoo or anything like that. This is just, I was interested that this movie skipped the part where he reanimates the corpse.
Yes.
And the plot centers around, how does he control it once it's animated? That's just something that other movies we've done have not. Most of them have spent most of their time on how is the corpse being reanimated in the first place. Not this movie.
We don't get any of that. But what is interesting about this zombie, we'll get into it more, is that it seems to have an inner life. It seems to have some memory of its previous existence. And we'll come back. We'll come back to that as we go through. So
yeah, I mean, not to skip ahead, but this is a zombie as a tragic victim. I think, if we're talking about our zombie tropes.
Yep,
he does some bad stuff, but I think ultimately you're meant to feel sorry for this guy.
I think so, and he has no other tools other than violence. Like, he seems to have degraded to that point, but he still recognizes his daughter, and sort of, you know, wistfully remembers what it was like. So, but we'll get into that as we go. Anything else in this first part before the plot thickens?
I think the only other thing I want to call out is you said that the first murder takes place in this opening act.
Am I wrong about that?
No, you're correct. It takes place quite early on, and we don't know it yet, but as the movie goes on, we're going to realize what's the tell of these murders that the police are later going to latch onto, and that we don't realize yet is the tell, but it ends up being a recurring theme.
Yeah. So what happens is Conrad goes to these burlesque shows or whatever, these cabarets, meets these women and gives them gifts. And one of the gifts he gives them is this necklace. And this is the homing beacon essentially for the zombie. So once this woman has the necklace on, he will send the zombie in and the zombie will strangle her.
Let's see. All right. My last comment here on this opening act is that I know it's just a feature of the times, but the romance between Juan Manuel and Melissa is so unpleasant by modern standards.
I know.
It's another situation where the guy is basically harassed this poor woman into finally, like, her defenses worn down. Into deciding that she likes him. It's just
exactly.
It's like the opposite of charming romance, I guess. And it just, I know this would have played differently in the 60s, but watching it today, it's so unpleasant that I was annoyed when Juan Manuel would appear on the screen because he's such a loser.
Yes.
I don't think that's what I would have thought had I been watching this in the 60s. So he's
a crack shot, it turns out later. But it reminded me of Woman Eater. There was that relationship between the mechanic and the showgirl, and he was so annoying, but he wore her down eventually.
But he acknowledged it too, which I found interesting, because she says, you think you're such a Don Juan, and he says, I'm Spanish. All Spanish men are Don Juan.
Right.
He said, this is who we are, is basically.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Although he does sort of touchingly admit he's a bit of a faker and softened during the film, but
I don't know if admitting that you're a loser is is something I want to praise. I guess, although I guess it's better than not admitting.
I guess not.
All right, let's carry on though, John.
Yeah, what? I think one of the reasons this seems kind of timeless is it's set in kind of a timeless way. Like, for example, they use a horse and carriage at one point, and the cars are older. Just my quick car review.
Oh yeah.
Dr. Fishman's, Conrad's car is a 1937 Chrysler Royale. And I don't know if you know this about Chrysler. Nobody in the modern age probably knows this about Chrysler. When it was first introduced up through about the 70s, Chrysler was actually a luxury brand, right? So that's to suggest he's a wealthy man.
Okay.
Whereas our boy Juan Manuel drives in a Spanish-made car. It's called a Seat in English. But it's a Seat 1450C from 1942. So basically, it's like an old junker. It's small. It's not as glamorous. It's like an A to B. It's like a VW Bug. It doesn't look like a VW Bug, but it just looks like a cheap car.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, we've got it. We've met all our characters.
We know everybody.
Zombie has been raised, and we've had our first murder. So now we kind of move into the bulk of the film, John.
Yeah, and in this sort of second part of the film, this is where Melissa becomes curious about her father, right? Like she at one point is harassing Cicero, who's like the handyman around town, and she gets a key from him that she later uses to go into her father's old room. And it's a wonderful scene but she actually sees her father, or does she? She worries she might be hallucinating. In any case, she... this is where she sort of commits to the bit of investigating, right? Like, I now want to see what happened to my father. I want to know more. Whereas when she came here, she didn't want to know more. And while that's happening, a couple things happen on Conrad's side, her uncle's side. He has a new victim. He is his quote unquote courting, and it is a singer in a cabaret. Actually, there's two musical numbers she does in this film. And they're both kind of great.
Yeah,
like, I don't know how you felt about it, but she's a jazz singer and she sings like this very sort of melodramatic, emotional song. And then she sings this comedy song in the second part. And I found them kind of delightful. But
the performer is Perla Kristal. That's the woman who sings and acts that scene. Those
and
scenes.
Is she singing her own?
She was a real life singer, yes.
Yeah, she's great. Like, her songs were really good. And I really enjoyed them anyway. Other things that happen here is Conrad is plotting his next kill, right? He's met this woman. He's given her the necklace, the things that are going to happen. At one point, Andros escapes his prison, and he's gone for the evening. And this is where we sort of first get the gothic tragedy aspect of Andros the zombie. Where does Conrad find him the next morning? What is Andros doing?
Andros has gone out to the cemetery, to his own grave.
And he's sort of staring at it forlornly throughout this.
So this was interesting because I was trying to remember if we've seen another zombie movie where the zombie master loses control of his zombie like this.
Yes, it's almost Frankenstein-esque in a way. Like, it feels more like Frankenstein than a zombie movie, because this character of Andros the zombie seems to have a little more free will than our typical zombie. It's more like he's a reduced capacity version of himself who is subjected to these ultrasonic sounds that control him. But if Conrad doesn't have the sounds, he can't control Andros.
And it's interesting to me that the zombie off of its tether is not a monstrous killer. It actually is a pretty sedate, mournful creature that doesn't seem like it really wants to harm anyone.
Yes. Yeah.
So I thought that was pretty interesting. Yeah. So Melissa's interest in her father, it comes from a lot of interactions with Ingrid, who's she's drunk or in a lot of these scenes, and she's just fallen into the state of despondency. And it's from Ingrid that Melissa starts to gather that there's a little bit more. She never knew her father. She starts to gather there's a little bit more to the story than that.
Yeah, there's two other things I wanted to pull out here. First of all, we meet our new character, a detective. So the second woman, the singer, Perla, is murdered by the zombie. The zombie is discovered fleeing, and actually the pursuers, there's an off-duty policeman in the cabaret, shoot at the zombie to no effect. And then the zombie punches the bouncer, who's also the singer's boyfriend, and knocks him right down. So that sort of sets the stage for the zombie being sort of superhuman.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that, and then I have one more bit I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I guess we should know the zombie kills by strangling you, basically.
Yes.
It doesn't, it's not trying to eat you or anything like that.
No.
It just kills you like a human murderer would.
Yes, but it seems unstoppable.
Yes.
It's like a Terminator. I think they refer to it as a robot later. But
they do. Robot comes up a couple of times.
So I'd like to introduce everybody to our detective, Detective Klein, the most condescending detective in all of Europe.
You knew the victim, is that right?
She was my girlfriend.
Yes, I tell you, this kid's a lady killer. I know how he operates. It's like an Almeria.
How interesting. What do you mean?
Well, don't get me wrong. He's a good kid, that's all. I feel it's time to help you.
What was your reaction to the murderer?
I found him with her. When he started to run, I grabbed him from behind and spun him around and got him all set up for an uppercut. But it was me that got clobbered. That type may look pretty easy to handle, but I took the worst follow from him I ever took in my life. He punches like a human power drill. I'm telling you, it's supernatural the way he can hit.
Suppose you restrict the rest of your account to the physical appearance of this great fighter.
Tall and dark, with gray eyes, pale looking, wearing dark clothes and gloves to match.
Excuse me.
Inspector?
Hmm?
We've just found out that the necklace the victim wore tonight exactly matches the one that was worn by the other woman who was killed a few nights ago in that all-night joint called Frida's. Yes, sir, and what's more, the method used to kill a woman in these two murders is exactly the same in both.
If you'll permit a lack of taste, Sergeant, I think I must express my feelings with a vulgar display of swearing. Gadzooks.
There you go. That's what you miss when you watch the French version.
I missed that high moment of high comedy. That's pretty good.
Do you remember what it was in the French version, Andy?
I don't know.
In the French version, he goes, merde, but the subtitles say we're up to our necks in it.
So this movie is exploitative, but only in certain specific ways.
Yes. And then I wanted to mention one other thing right at the end of sort of the second act in this sequence. After murdering this woman and coming back home, Andros escapes again in the middle of the night, and he breaks into Melissa's room. But rather than killing her, it's clear that he recognizes her, and he sort of sits on the edge of her bed, stroking her hair, and she wakes up and realizes that might be her father. She's not certain.
Yeah.
But when we hear Conrad coming home in the car, Andros flees and goes back and locks himself back in his room.
Yeah.
Anything else from sort of this middle act that you wanted to bring in? I think that's all the big stuff.
I don't think so. So just as a reminder, Juan Manuel has been lurking around the fringes of the story.
That's right.
He's not really welcome in the castle, but he is around and he's going to show up in the final act to sort of be our hero, I suppose, in a certain way. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of drama with Ingrid remembering. This is where we hear the whole story about how Ingrid fell in love with Andros, had a brief affair, and then when her husband learned about it, he murdered Andros, and they passed off his death as like a botched surgery.
Yes, but here, I've got a clip of that, and I want to play it, because Ingrid is so melodramatic. It's delightfully weird.
Conrad suspected us. He watched us like a green-eyed cat. One day we were alone and he caught us. He murdered your father right in front of me. He stabbed him in the back of the neck with a surgical scalpel. You know, he'd have killed me too. But he must have thought about what it would mean. He knew I'd suffer more if he didn't kill me. He made me be part of a charade that worked to perfection. Your father played the part of an invalid who died under the knife during an operation. With him safely in the tomb, your uncle had nervous prostrations, and so did I.
So there's so many great things about that. Yeah. Nervous prostrations. Also, how would it feel if your drunk aunt told you that your father was murdered by your uncle? Like, just came out with it. Why not?
Yes.
It's pretty fantastic. We also get here an interview with the boxer. So that guy who was talking earlier about throwing a punch at the zombie, he's a boxer. And this is where they make the connection about the necklace. And there's actually a wonderful little scene where the detective is listening and he takes out a nail file and he starts doing his nails. And the boxer mentions the necklace, and it's like the aha moment for the detective, and he realizes that they're related, but we're focused in on his hands, and like he stops polishing them for a second as they're speaking. I don't know. I just found that really, really delightful.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the camera focusing in on stuff, I don't think we mentioned. So this movie has a lot of eye shots.
Yeah. Eyeball so, city, man. Yeah.
It's an Italian, gothic vibe, lots of close-ups of eyes.
And there's this motif of Andros where the first time we see him is at the very beginning of the movie in Conrad's flashback, where he is looking over the shoulder of the woman he's sleeping with, looking at Conrad, and his eyes are huge and wide. And then we see him throughout the rest of the film, his eyes are like that.
There are, I don't know if I can articulate this, you kind of just have to watch it. There are a couple of funny moments the camera rapidly zooms out on something.
Yes.
And like normally this would be kind of a tool for suspense. Like it rapidly zooms out to reveal there's a monster next to you, but it's never used in that context. It's always used in more mundane contexts.
Right.
And so it's like this, the camera itself feels like this really melodramatic participant in the story in a way that was kind of fun.
Yes, I think so.
Franco is known for the handheld camera like this and doing a lot of zooms. So you're experiencing what became his style.
Okay. It made it feel strangely modern in a way.
It did, yes, yeah. Totally.
Yep. Yeah, even though it feels both timeless but sort of more modern. I thought it was really interesting. However, back to Conrad, he's getting sloppy. He needs another kill to feel better again, just like a serial killer. So he goes to an opium den. This scene was wild.
Yeah.
Do you want to say anything about this scene? I thought it was very interesting.
Just that this is what made me pause the movie and go Google opium dens and go down that that track. Yeah, it's shot in a dreamlike, surreal fashion.
Yes.
People are sort of lounging around listlessly. And yeah, I don't know. What do you want to call out from this scene?
There's this woman who's like writhing and dancing. It's not even a dance. It looks like, I don't even know what, but I grabbed another clip of music here that I thought was great that plays over her sort of rolling around.
Her rolling and everyone else experiencing the opium.
Yes. What that is, but it's kind of great.
Yes.
So she takes a hit off Conrad's pipe, and we find out that, and then very quickly, it's the next night, and Conrad sends Andros the zombie to kill her. What I think is interesting about this, there's a couple interesting bits here. So the woman here, who's later referred to as a den mother, I'm not kidding, in the English translation,
yeah.
She receives a necklace from Conrad. However, she doesn't keep it. She gives it to her friend. So the next night when Conrad comes back with Andros, the killing machine, Andros singles out the friend because we find out the necklace has an ultrasonic thing in it that makes Andros track that enemy. And then he throws the body in the river. However, he is witnessed. So this whole thing falls apart. But the other thing that was really creepy here was that as she's dying, you see Conrad, and he sort of has this look of like relief on his face as she's murdered, which gives you that sort of serial killer, you know, taking vengeance on women kind of vibe that is here. So that scene is creepy. And then something else important happens, but I wanted you to see if you had anything on that scene before we moved on to it.
No, I like this scene quite a bit, and I like the general sense we're getting to. I mean, the end of the movie is coming up, and
yeah, we're about to tip downhill here.
I enjoy that moment where the noose starts to tighten around the villain. Like you said, he's getting sloppy,
yes.
And there isn't really any sense that he isn't going to get caught, right?
Right.
And I would go so far as to say he maybe doesn't care all that much if he gets caught. I mean, he's pretty far gone, I think.
Yeah, I think so. But then we get this scene. It's very short. We come back. This is the only other time we see Dr. Orloff, and it's, I think, his wife or his nurse in like the sunroom reading him the paper, and she just lays it all out for him right here.
Certain questions in the case of the Hofen Strangler continue to baffle the authorities. Inspector Diaz admitted to reporters today. How does the Strangler select his victims? What makes him apparently invulnerable? Why was each of the three murdered girls wearing the same type of necklace? What is the significance of these identical necklaces? Experts have appraised them as worthless. In fact, a prominent jeweler of this city declared that in his opinion, they looked like clumsy hearing aids rather than jewelry.
So that pretty much lays it out. And this is where Dr. Orloff realizes he has created a monster. So
yeah.
So we get to the title of Dr. Orloff's monster. It's not Andros the zombie, it's Conrad. Right? And he's the one who has, who is the monster here. He's the
As
real
always,
monster.
As always, it's humans that are the real monsters.
That's right. That's right. Now, a bunch of stuff happens here. I just wanted to say that setup. So what happens then is Dr. Orloff calls Inspector Diaz and tries to anonymously tips off Diaz about what's happening and then hangs up the phone immediately.
Yeah.
And lets Diaz sort of put it together. But we're rapidly heading downhill. Andros kills Ingrid in a very sort of weirdly sexual scene where she seems to be having a stroke or an orgasm or something. How did this scene play for you guys? Because it seemed very weird to me.
So this was an interesting scene. I read it that she died basically of shock from seeing him, less than him actually murdering her. So remember, this is her dead lover that she is.
And she doesn't know that he's a zombie.
Right. And I mean, her whole life has been ruined over her love for this man. So he appears in her room at night. She's lying in bed. And she just kind of does this series of kind of convulsions that I read as like basically having a heart attack or something like that.
Yeah.
It closes with this really great shot of Andros standing over the bed. She's dead, lying in the bed, and a lamp is a hanging lamp is penduluming back and forth over her body because she hit it, I think, during one of her convulsions.
Yes.
I don't know, I thought it was pretty great, and her acting is really over the top.
Yes.
But you know, it fits with the vibe of this film.
Well, there's a little bit of artfulness to all of this, like sort of, you know, like when like the scene you're describing, and when the singer is killed earlier, the second woman to be killed, she dies, and they zoom in on her hand that like plays all the keys down the piano as she's being murdered. It's very romantic and big in every way. So this is finally where the cops and Inspector Klein pull it all together. He gets the anonymous tip from Dr. Orloff. He's figured out the connection of the necklaces. He's doing some investigation. He's interviewed a couple people, including the quote unquote den mother, who should have been the victim, but ended up not being the victim. And this is how he puts it all together.
What's the news?
Well, we've checked the necklaces and they did turn out to be ultrasonic transmitters.
Do you think these sound waves could make a lifeless creature obey mechanically?
That's right. They can, sir. I'm reminded of the work of Dr. Orloff. He experimented with a robot which responded to ultrasonics. The mechanism wasn't perfected, but it could certainly render a person almost invincible.
But don't you think such a robot would have its Achilles heel?
That's what most concerned Dr. Orloff. The vital spot has to be at the base of the skull, but the insertion of a receiver could be fatal.
Uh-huh. You've hit the nail on the head. Order all cars. We're leaving immediately.
Yeah, so first of all, I love the jump that the inspector makes here.
Yeah, I know. Thank you, Captain Exposition.
Yeah. Wait, ultrasonics? Couldn't you use that to control a dead body? I'm like, whoa, wait. How'd you get there?
The confidence with which the other one responds. Like, well, of course, if you just insert it in the base of the neck, as Dr. Orloff's experiments showed.
Yes.
Can I just say, kind of Dr. Orloff not coming across real well in this movie. And he started this all by... His mad science started this all, and the best he can do is an anonymous phone tip.
I know.
Come on.
Yeah. So now we're racing downhill. Andros kills Orloff and almost kills Juan Manuel and then flees the house just as the police arrive. And they have to come up with a plan to kill him because now Andros the zombie, her father, is running around out there. And they realize they need to do something and that he needs to be killed. Orloff is dead. They don't know how to control him, right? The secret is lost with him.
Yeah.
So what do they ask Melissa to do? I thought this was delightfully tragic.
So, yeah. So I actually, this was some pretty strong stuff for this movie, actually.
Yeah.
So Melissa is asked basically to lead her zombie father out to where they can get a clean shot at him, essentially.
Yeah.
And she agrees and... I would go so far as to say it was kind of a moving sequence of scenes.
It really was. Like, she is beckoning to him, and he slowly follows her, and she knows what he's doing.
She's leading him like a tentative child or something like that. She's beckoning him with her hands, like, come on out, it's going to be okay, follow me, follow me. And he does, and then she leads him into the open, and then... It's kind of funny that Juan Manuel was taking the shot here.
I know.
Like, what's he doing?
They have police sharpshooters. I don't know. You know, he was in the movie. They didn't want to give another character a name. Who knows?
Yeah. And you know what else I think real snipers don't do? They don't shout, hey, Melissa, take cover before they take their shot. Like, isn't the point you're supposed to be shooting from surprise? I don't know.
They also don't use old Winchester rifles from
no, they don't.
From the Old West. However, so she lures him to his death. Now, the one thing I wanted to mention here is this death takes place in front of like a kiosk with ads on it. And there's this giant smiling panda, that I think holding an orange. And I'm like, did anybody else notice the panda where he was shot?
I wondered if that was... like high art that was just going past me or just happened to be in the shot.
My guess is it was advertisement for oranges. That's what it was. So
quick question here.
Yeah.
So I kind of missed how they figured out how to kill him. So what is different about this killing shot? Because we've seen the zombie shrug off bullets earlier in the film.
Well, that's why I played the clip earlier from the detectives. It's at the Achilles heel is at the base of the skull.
The skull. Okay, got it.
Now, but in the French version,
yeah,
the dub says between the temple. So they make it like a clear headshot.
Oh, interesting.
But in the English dub, it's the base of the skull.
Oh, all right.
Interesting. The film clearly does not show a headshot, I don't think.
There's, yeah.
It shows his head, and there's no bullet hole in his head, yeah.
He just falls over. But then we have one last clip to finish the film, because I thought this was also excellent.
Thank you.
Those are the only words spoken by Andros in the whole film while he's lying on the ground, expiring, and his daughter is crying over him. Finny, we are done.
That is kind of interesting. So again, I watched it in French with English subtitles, mm-hmm. and the subtitles have him asking why.
Oh, wow. French versus American right there. Yeah.
Which kind of changes the tone of the scene.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting to me. Wow. Okay. Well, we'll have to get into it.
Yeah. And
well,
I mean, there's the our answer movie. To the question why is pretty obvious, because you're a zombie who's been serial killing women. Yeah. But, you know.
Maybe he's asking, why am I a zombie? Why did this happen to me?
Yeah. This feels like a very existential French question in your French version. Like, like, should I kill this man or not when I'm staring at the sea? You know?
Right. So, hey, John, anything else you want to call out, or do we want to get into our post-movie recap questions?
Let's do it.
Okay. All right, I'm going to walk us through the questions we ask about every zombie movie we watch. This is to place these films in sort of the context of the zombie movie timeline. So, John, in Dr. Orloff's Monster, is there a hero party?
There is. I think it's Melissa, Juan Manuel, and the detective, Detective Klein. I think they qualify as a party, hero party.
So I want to talk about the detective stuff, and I might as well do it now.
Yeah.
So this is not the first movie that has occasionally cut over to the police, who are kind of piecing together the what's going on, and then to set up a finale where the police come in basically and kill the monster.
Yeah, I think we're so used to it now in like modern television, this sort of procedural stuff, but I think it's still fairly new for us in the timeline.
That said, this wasn't very good police procedural stuff. Like, because the police mostly stand around talking about how bewildered they are at what's going on. And they solve it because someone just phones them and gives them the answer, kind of. So that took away a lot of the interestingness of the pretty substantial police scenes in this film. Because they're not like solving the crime. They're just kind of observing what you, the viewer, already know because you watched the murder. And I think there's like a nuance to what makes a good detective story.
Right.
And it's not just in like recounting to you a murder that you just witnessed, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. But I think his condescension and his sort of irritating tone with everybody is the one thing that keeps him entertaining.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's pretty entertaining to watch, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. I enjoyed the detective. They took a lot of time creating his character. He's a germaphobe. There's all these scenes and moments where people are trying to touch him and he's backing away, or
he's got a cold
rubbing
all
his
the
hands.
Time.
Yeah. And I thought it was kind of neat how they created him. Was it needed or useful? No.
Yeah. I think they do a lot more. Like, he's more developed than Melissa is, frankly. Like, all we know about Melissa is that her dad is dead and her uncle's the murderer. Like, that's her identity, you know?
All right. Anyway, back to our questions. John, so that hero party we just identified, how did they do? How many of them survived this movie?
They all survived, though. You think Juan Manuel's died because Andros does strangle him at one point, but he survives.
That's right. Yeah. All right, in this movie, let's talk about the zombie in this film, John. What kind of zombie are we dealing with here?
So we're dealing with a dead body, reanimated scientifically and controlled scientifically. So it is a science zombie for sure.
All right. How is that zombie destroyed or killed?
Actually, it's with a headshot, Andy.
Yeah.
Like, is this our first headshot claim? Well, in my version, it's the base of the skull. In yours, it's, you know, in between the eyes. But in either case, like, it's, you kill him with a headshot.
Revenge of the Zombies, they talk about separating the brain from the body, and that would end
they
it.
They do, but they
but
don't.
We don't see it.
You don't see it. And here, it's pretty explicit. Like I don't know that there's, you know, I doubt George Romero ever saw this, but like it's there, right, as far as a zombie clue. And this might be our first one.
The idea that there's a weak point in the zombie I don't think this is the first movie that has posited that. I'm really trying to think how this has been handled in past movies. It is certainly not common that the zombies are invulnerable except for one spot if you shoot it, whether it's the neck or the head.
Right. So, but I feel like this is new for us in our journey here.
That's pretty interesting. It is interesting for a couple of reasons, I think. So an awful lot of the zombies we've seen in these movies are just invulnerable.
Yeah.
They can't be stopped by anything. This is a zombie that can be stopped by a very mundane, everyday thing, a bullet.
Yeah.
But only if you hit its weak spot, which is like a middle ground between some zombies we've seen, which can just be taken out the way a human can.
Right.
And the other inhumanly invulnerable ones. So.
Right.
All right. I won't belabor that further. Let's see. There's no zombie horde in this one because there's only the one zombie. And it's only really suggested that he ever has done this on only his brother-in-law, right?
Yes, correct.
Is the world threatened in Dr. Orloff's Monster?
No, it's pretty small. It's a small-scale Gothic family melodrama, you know?
This is an expression of the kind of private angsts of the characters and no more than that.
Yes.
All right, how fast is the zombie in this movie? Superhuman speed, subhuman speed, or regular person speed?
He's regular person speed, though you don't know it at first. At first, he wanders very slowly, and then, like, when he's being chased out of the cabaret, he, like, runs up the stairs and, like... So he's, and he climbs over a wall. So he's basically human speed.
Yes. And he's got a little bit, in addition to having that speed, he's got a little bit, I wouldn't say he's clever, but he's not like a Walking Dead type zombie that's just a shambling husk.
No, he seems to have some intelligence to escape or whatever, because he escapes a couple of times.
Exactly.
And he disposes of one of the bodies into the bay without any direction.
He just feels so much like Frankenstein's monster to me.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Can he return to being human? Can his zombie state be reversed?
No, he's dead.
Yeah, he has that. There's that haunting sense that he is a little bit aware of his fate and maybe doesn't like it, but it's not enough that he ever returns. I mean, we see him choosing not to kill Melissa in one scene, basically, right? So he can sort of...
He has some agency,
but yeah. And then lastly, so with all of that said, and we've already answered this question a little bit, what are some of the zombie firsts, if any, that are in this movie and this zombie?
Well, I think the headshot, for sure, is a first. It feels like that to me. But also... I don't know. Like, we've seen Gothic movies before. We've had the same trope with the castle and the niece, all that. Have we had a zombie sort of this tragic? It's not our first tragic zombie, but it's maybe our most tragic zombie so far.
I actually marked this down too. I think it is a pretty noteworthy element of this, that this is zombie as tragic victim.
Yes. Yeah.
You really don't, again, the threat here. Yeah, the zombie is killing people, but The person who has it worst in this movie is Andrus, the zombie.
Yeah, and I think you have a sense that he is aware of his previous life and lives in sort of mournful regret and has this agency, so he's more tragic than any other one.
I don't think it's a first, but this is one of our most blatant examples of a zombie slipping, not following orders. Like,
yes.
This zombie master has more trouble than most of our zombie masters getting his pet zombie to behave.
With the exception of John Carradine in Revenge of the Zombies, who gets drowned by his own zombie. Oh, yes. No, I guess it's the same, because Dr. Fishman Conrad gets strangled by his own zombie.
We've had zombies break loose and kill their masters in the past.
Yes.
This one felt a little different. Like, you know, when he gets free of his master's control, he doesn't turn on his master. He just kind of goes off and does something else for a while. I just thought it was a little interesting.
Yeah.
It's also our first Spanish zombie, even though it's set in Germany.
That's right.
It's made by a Spanish director.
Oh, yeah. So I was going to say, so one of the confusions about the sense of place in this film is I think this movie takes place in Germany. Melissa is Austrian.
Yep.
Juan Manuel is Spanish, and they're all speaking French.
Yes.
So it's just a curious combination of cultures and languages.
Yeah.
All right, John, early in the podcast, you identified four pillars of the zombie film. Let's find out how many of them are present in Dr. Orloff's Monster.
All right.
John, in this movie, is there an apocalypse?
No apocalypse.
Is there contagion?
No contagion. It seems very hard to become a zombie. In fact, it's a scientific miracle that he was able to make this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does this movie feature tough moral choices?
It absolutely does in a couple of interesting ways. So first off, Andros is doing these murders and he does not want to, right? So he is forced to. And so he has the tough moral choice of eventually killing Conrad, right? But also Melissa makes a very tough moral choice. They basically say to her, your father's gone. He's a zombie. The best thing for everybody and him would be for you to lure him into a place where we can kill him.
Yeah.
And that is gut-wrenching. And that is a choice that Melissa has to make.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. This is a pretty clear moral choice in the way that we envisioned it.
Yes.
And lastly, does this movie feature loved ones turning against you?
Yeah, absolutely. Andros, in theory, loved his brother and his brother's wife and Melissa, and he kills two out of those three people. So.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, for sure. All right. Do you want to ask your 60s questions?
Yeah. So the other thing we're doing here is asking 60s questions. These are sort of America-centric, but let's see how they stand up to European horror. So do we see an increase in violence and grittiness in this film from the 50s films we'd watched before?
So the violence in this movie is pretty bloodless and in line with the tame movies of the 50s, I would say, 40s and 50s.
The blatant strangling looked a little more grotesque than in other movies.
You think so?
Okay. I don't know that we would have seen that in the 50s.
Well, I think the way that it's different from the 50s is that these murders are drawn out. They're not gorier, they're not bloodier, but you have to kind of sit through them, and they can be a little uncomfortable because of that. So in other ways, this movie, and I don't know if this is a European thing where they're less interested in the gore, but you get more of the sexuality and stuff, but there is a lot of, like, I don't think there's any actual nudity in this film, but anytime a dancing girl can be shown in a state of undress, she is. So
yeah, absolutely.
So this movie, I think, is in line with our 60s boundary pushing elements.
Yeah. What about, speaking of that, what about questioning authority?
I don't think, I didn't get much of that vibe from this movie. And while that's a very 1960s thing, I don't know if it feels like a gothic thing.
Yeah. What about Juan Manuel and Melissa at the end, where she's sort of, where they're sort of independent youths who are solving their own problem? Like, is Juan Manuel sort of a rebel, maybe a little bit?
I can see that. Part of the problem is that the plan at the end of this movie is really pitched to them by the police, the
authority
figures.
That's true. Yeah, you're
so
right.
So it doesn't feel like something that, it doesn't feel like Melissa came to a realization of what she needed to do so much as that she was convinced by the local authorities.
Yeah.
What
you're
she
right.
needs to do. Yeah. So maybe a little bit, but not a lot. So,
yeah. All right. How about this one? Focus on the hero's inner life, more personalized horror.
So totally.
Yeah.
This is a movie. It's all about people's inner lives and their inner thoughts and how those are affected when they gain new information. So
yes.
As with our other one or two gothic horror movies we've watched, this is as much a movie about the villain's inner life as it is about the heroes.
Yeah.
These murders and this whole zombie, I almost said shenanigans, but I won't. The zombie business that he gets up to is just a reflection of his kind of insane psychological turmoil from the betrayal that that he felt when he found out his wife was having an affair, that the two people he loved, you know, most in life were both betraying him.
Yeah.
And all of the crimes stem from that. That's a real personalized sort of horror. And as far as the heroes go, you know, this is family horror. This is horrible because the people committing it and being victimized by it are all parts of your loved inner circle family.
Yes.
And that feels interesting and very of the times.
And I particularly like how it is sort of revealed to Melissa, this whole world of personalized horror that she was unaware of, and how she gets drawn into it, which really sort of personalizes it too.
Yes. And it feels very gothic that, you know, behind this facade of classiness and austere authority, there is just this rot of of hatreds and jealousies and bitterness.
Yep. I don't know about these next ones, so you tell me, is there a fear of crime, societal chaos, or anarchy in this movie?
I don't think so. I think this movie is trying to be titillating a bit with the fact that the murders are take place in these seedy nightclubs.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's really trying to say anything one way or the other about, you know, crime and violence.
No, I mean, it just sort of accepts that those places exist.
Yeah.
You know, the cabaret is not some poorly attended a men's club. It's packed, right, with men who are going to see a woman dance and sing. Okay, so what about, so these are together, but maybe we want to separate them for this movie. Sense of looming apocalypse and psychological stress.
So I'm going to answer yes. So there's a lot of psychological stress, and this movie does ratchet up the feeling of impending doom as the minutes tick along. The doom, interestingly, is not the doom is not that like the good guys are going to be swept up in some terrible fate. It's more like, when is the noose going to close around Conrad and bring his story, this grisly story, to a close? So I think you can almost hear the clock ticking on how, I mean, I do enjoy a good movie where the villain starts to get sloppy and his plans start to unravel as it goes along. This movie did deliver that. So I'm going to say, yeah, but the sense of looming apocalypse is extremely localized and personal. It's not any sort of global apocalypse. Yeah.
And Ingrid, her whole life is psychological stress, right? Like induced by the crimes of the past. So, yeah. Horrors without solutions, lack of clear villains to defeat.
I'm going to give this a qualified yes.
Oh, really?
So there is a clear villain here, but the... he's a villain because of some common to humanity things that we do.
Right.
I don't know. Like, so this is all set in motion. He's a little unbalanced, I guess, but it's all set in motion by this affair between his wife and his brother-in-law.
Yes.
And his brother, or his wife and his brother.
Yes.
And to me, when you get to a story like that, it starts to have a little bit more of like a timeless feel. Like, people are always pulling these sorts of stunts, right?
Yeah.
And so this turned into a horror movie because when it happened, one of the people involved was teetering on the brink of psychological madness.
Yeah.
So I want to say, I mean, they do defeat him. The threat is dead. So in that sense, yeah, they solved this problem, is solved, and it's not coming back.
Right.
But people are going to do the things that led to this over and over again. So
yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. All right. Well, let's wrap it up here.
All right. We close with three final questions, John. John, would you and I survive in the zombie world of Dr. Orloff's monster?
I'm going to go with maybe here, because if we, assuming we aren't part of this family, we could still get drawn in by in the way that like Juan Manuel or the detective are. And Juan Manuel is almost killed, but he's not killed. So I don't know. He's about 30 years younger than me, so maybe that's a yes for me. I probably would get strangled in his position. So
I think I would survive this one, John. And the reason is, it's kind of, you have to work pretty hard to get killed by this zombie in this movie.
That's true.
You have to be a hyper-specific type of person who's like the victim, or you really have to get up in the zombie master's business to get on the hit list. So
yeah, you're right.
I think I have a good shot of surviving this.
I'm fairly confident I would survive, because knowing myself, I know that I would not be a burlesque dancer.
Well, there's that too.
Yes.
All right, John, is this a zombie movie, or is this a movie with zombies?
It's a zombie movie, but not in the way we usually mean it. It's focused around the sort of tragedy of Andros the zombie. So I'm going to say, yeah.
I agree. And I don't really have anything to add to that.
Yeah.
Lastly, John, do you recommend this movie first as a movie that just people generally would find worth watching? Secondly, do you recommend it specifically to the zombie-loving fans of this podcast?
So I'm going to go for the first one, no, because I actually liked it, but it's a little too low budget and it's a little too hard to find. And there's these weird choices about what language to watch it in. I just don't know. It's just not solid enough for me to say yes. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But But I would, as far as zombie fans, because I think it's an interesting take on the zombie. It has the first headshot, which I think is, you know, something we've been looking for this whole time. And I sort of didn't realize it until we were talking about it, that it was here. So I'd say yes to our zombie fans.
I would answer the same way. It's not, I didn't mind watching this one. This was enjoyable to watch, yeah. But not so much that I think you need to go hunt it down.
Yeah, but it's not terrible. It just looks like it was made very cheaply. And there's some wonderful artful direction in it, but ultimately it doesn't quite all come together.
Yeah. With the zombie bits, I think I would give it a very soft recommendation to zombie fans. I don't think you need to watch this, but like John said, there's a couple of interesting zombie elements. And you know what? Because specifically this trope has vanished from the world of zombie media,
right?
Generally speaking, I'm very partial to stories about tragic zombies.
Yeah, I am too. Again, it has that tragedy of Frankenstein's monster kind of vibe to it that I really enjoyed. You know.
All right. Well, we've survived to the end here, and that means it's time for the scariest part of the show. That's where producer Brad tells us what zombie movie we will be watching next. Take it away, Brad.
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, first up, Andy, you're very prescient with your discussion at the top of the show.
Uh-oh.
And your desire to see how zombies are portrayed in other mediums.
Aha.
Oh.
So I'll play the clip. I don't have a trailer for this, but I'll play a clip. And as it's playing, I will then show you the poster.
Okay.
Here we go.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness.
The man from Uncle. The very important zombie affair.
I am so excited about this. Oh, I used to, my mom loves this show. And so that meant I watched episodes of it when I was a kid growing up. So
yes, my dad loved this show.
Okay. Yeah. So just to reiterate, this is an episode of the show, The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Yes.
Called The Very Important Zombie Affair. And I guess it doesn't have its own poster and stuff, but we do have a pretty good still shot here of
the title card from the show.
Yeah, of a doctor, someone reaching out and touching the head of someone that looks like a zombie, you know?
Yeah,
is that a zombie?
Hard to tell. The letters are in front of his face, but could be. Isn't Peter Graves the guy? He's the voice, right? A man, he's like the leader.
I don't know.
Robert Vaughn is Napoleon Solo.
All right, but who's the old? Never mind. We'll talk about it when we get there. I am curious. I'm very curious to see what happens in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Has this had a second-rate IP reboot that wasn't worth watching? I feel
it had Henry Cavill and who played the Russian.
I've seen it. It wasn't the worst thing I've seen.
Henry Cavill's in everything.
Yeah,
it's so strange. I mean, more power to him, but I just,
I mean, I think I have a copy of it on the shelf back there.
He's got a square jaw.
Directed by Guy Ritchie, and it was Henry Cavill and Armie Hammer.
Okay. We can probably skip that one.
Alas, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say, I'm excited. It's been a little heavy. The show's been a little heavy lately. So
yes.
I am kind of excited for something that is pretty much guaranteed to be some lighthearted fun. So
yeah, I think so.
And only 50 minutes long.
Oh,
and only 50 minutes long. And hopefully it doesn't feature horrible racism like the Batman thing or horrible tragedy like Dr. Orloff's Monster. We could just use it a nice little TV show. I'm kind of excited.
This is a good one. All right. Very good.
Excellent. Well, hey, everybody, if you haven't subscribed or given us a 5-star review in your podcast app of choice, please go do that. We will wait right here while you're doing that. And seriously, thank you all for listening. We'll catch you next week for The Man from U.N.C.L.E. You've been listening to Zombie Strains. We'll be back next episode to talk about another zombie movie. If you enjoyed our podcast, please take a moment to rate us in your podcast app of choice. Tell a friend, follow us on Instagram at Zombie Strains. All of this helps like-minded people find the show. See you next time.